He'll spill everything, everything.
He grinned at Robin.
We'll leave for the moon tomorrow night. Book passage. No, there'll be trouble on account of the attack. Buy a ship. They'll be unloading them cheap anyway.
We? Robin said. You mean you?
I mean we, Foyle answered. We're going to the moon, both of us.
I'm leaving.
You're not leaving. You're staying with me.
But you swore you'd...
Grow up, girl. I had to swear to anything to get this. I need you more than ever now, not for Vorga. I'll handle Vorga myself, for something much more important.
He looked at her incredulous face and smiled ruefully.
It's too bad, girl. If you'd given me this letter 2 hours ago, I'd have kept my word. But it's too late now. I need a romance secretary. I'm in love with Olivia Prestain.
She leaped to her feet in a blaze of fury. You're in love with her? Olivia Prestain? In love with that white corpse?
The bitter fury of her telesending was a startling revelation to him. Ah, now you have lost me. Forever. Now I'll destroy you.
She disappeared. Chapter 12. Captain Peter Yang Yeovil was handling reports at Central Intelligence HQ in London at the rate of 6 per minute. Information was phoned in, wired in, cabled in, jaunted in. The bombardment picture unfolded rapidly. Attack saturated North and South America from 60 degrees to 120 degrees west longitude. Labrador to Alaska in north, Rio to Ecuador in south. Estimated 10% missiles penetrated interception screen. Estimated population loss, 10 to 12 million.
Thank God for jaunting, Yang Yeovil said, or the losses would have been 5 times that.
All the same, it's close to a knockout. One more punch like that and Terra's finished.
He addressed this to the assistants, jaunting in and out of his office, appearing and disappearing, dropping reports on his desk, and chalking results and equations on the glass blackboard that covered one entire wall. Informality was the rule, and Yang Yeovil was surprised and suspicious when an assistant knocked on his door and entered with elaborate formality.
What larceny now? Lady to see you, Yo?
Is this the time for comedy?
Yang Yeovil said in exasperated tones. He pointed to the whitehead equations spelling disaster on the transparent blackboard.
Read that, and weep on the way out. Very special, Lady Yo. You're Venus from the Spanish Stairs.
Who? What Venus?
Your Congo Venus.
Oh, that one?
Yang Yeovil hesitated.
Send her in.
You'll interview her in private, of course.
Of course nothing. There's a war on. Keep those reports coming, but tip everybody to switch to secret speech if they have to talk to me.
Robin Wednesbury entered the office, still wearing the torn white evening gown. She had jaunted immediately from New York to London without bothering to change. Her face was strained, but lovely. Yang Yeovil gave her a split-second inspection, and realized that his first appreciation of her had not been mistaken. Robin returned the inspection, and her eyes dilated.
But you're the cook from the Spanish Stairs, Angelo Poggi.
As an intelligence officer, Yang Yeovil was prepared to deal with this crisis.
Not a cook, madam. I still haven't had time to change back to my usual fascinating self. Please sit here, Miss Wednesbury. Robin Wednesbury.
Charmed. I am Captain Yang Yeovil.
How nice of you to come and see me, Miss Wednesbury. You have saved me a long, hard search. But I don't understand. What were you doing on the Spanish Stairs? Why were you hunting?
Yang Yeovil saw that her lips weren't moving.
Ah, you're a telepath, Miss Wednesbury. How is that possible? I thought I knew every telepath in the system. I'm not a full telepath. I'm a telesend. I can only send, not receive. Which, of course, makes you worthless to the world.
I see.
Yang Yeovil cocked a sympathetic eye at her.
"'What a dirty trick, Miss Wednesbury. "'To be saddled with all the disadvantages of telepathy, "'and be deprived of all the advantages. "'I do sympathize, believe me. "'Bless him. "'He's the first ever to realize that without being told. "'Careful, Miss Wednesbury. "'I'm receiving you. "'Now, about the Spanish stairs?'
"'He paused, listening intently to her agitated telesending.
"'Why was he hunting? Me? Alien belich— Oh, God! Will they hurt me? Cut and— Information! I—'
"'My dear girl,' Yang Yeovil said gently. He took her hands and held them sympathetically. "'Listen to me a moment. You're alarmed over nothing. Apparently you're an alien belligerent, yes?' She nodded. "'That's unfortunate, but we won't worry about it now. About intelligence cutting and slicing information out of people, that's all propaganda.'
"'Propaganda?
We're not maladroits, Miss Wednesbury. We know how to extract information without being medieval. But we spread the legend to soften people up in advance, so to speak.
Is that true? He's lying. It's a trick.'
"'It's true, Miss Wednesbury. I do finesse, but there's no need now. Not when you've evidently come of your own free will to offer information.
He's too adroit, too quick. He—'
"'You sound as though you've been badly tricked recently, Miss Wednesbury. Badly burned.
I have. God, I have. By myself, mostly. I'm a fool, a hateful fool.'
"'Never a fool, Miss Wednesbury, and never hateful. "'I don't know what's happened to shatter your opinion of yourself, "'but I hope to restore it. "'So, you've been deceived, have you? "'By yourself, mostly? "'We all do that. "'But you've been helped by someone.
"'Who? "'I'm betraying him.
"'Then don't tell me.
"'But I've got to find my mother and sisters.' I can't trust him any more. I've got to do it myself.
Robin took a deep breath.
I want to tell you about a man named Gulliver Foyle.
Yang Yeovil at once got down to business.
Is it true he arrived by railroad? Olivia Prestane asked. In a locomotive, an observation car? What wonderful audacity!
Yes. "'He's a remarkable young man,' Prestane answered. "'He stood, iron-grey and iron-hard, in the reception hall of his home, alone with his daughter. "'He was guarding honour and life, while he waited for servants and staff to return from their panic-stricken jaunt to safety. "'He chatted imperturbably with Olivia, never once permitting her to realise their grave danger.
"'Father, I'm exhausted.'
"'It's been a trying night, my dear, but please don't retire yet.'
"'Why not?'
Prestane refrained from telling her that she would be safer with him.
"'I'm lonely, Olivia. We'll talk for a few minutes.'
"'I did a daring thing, Father. I watched the attack from the garden.'
"'My dear, alone?'
"'No, with Fourmile.'
A heavy pounding began to shake the front door, which Prestane had closed.
"'What's that?'
"'Looters,' Prestane answered calmly. "'Don't be alarmed, Olivia. They won't get in.'
He stepped to a table on which he had laid out an assortment of weapons, as neatly as a game of patience.
"'There's no danger, my love.' He tried to distract her. "'You were telling me about Fourmile.'
"'Oh, yes. We watched together, describing the bombing to each other.'
"'Unchaperoned? That wasn't discreet, Olivia.'
"'I know, I know. I behaved disgracefully. He seemed so big, so sure of himself, that I gave him the Lady Auteur treatment. You remember Miss Post, my governess, who was so dignified and aloof that I called her Lady Auteur? I acted like Miss Post. He was furious, Father. That's why he came looking for me in the garden.'
"'And you permitted him to remain?' "'I'm shocked, dear.'
"'I am, too. I think I was half out of my mind with excitement.
"'What's he like, Father? Tell me. What's he look like to you?'
"'He is big. Tall, very dark. Rather enigmatic, like a Borgia. He seems to alternate between assurance and savagery.
Ah, he is savage, then. I could see it myself. He glows with danger. Most people just shimmer. He looks like a lightning bolt. It's terribly fascinating.
My dear, Prestaine remonstrated gently, unmarried females are too modest to talk like that. It would displease me, my love, if you were to form a romantic attachment for a parvenu like 4 Mile of Ceres. The Prestaine staff jaunted into the reception hall, cooks, waitresses, footmen, pages, coachmen, valets, maids. All were shaken and hangdog after their flight from death. "'You have deserted your posts. It will be remembered,' Prestaine said coldly. "'My safety and honour are again in your hands. Guard them. Lady Olivia and I will retire.' He took his daughter's arm and led her up the stairs, savagely protective of his ice-pure princess. "'Blood and money,' Prestaine murmured.
"'What, father?'
"'I was thinking of a family vice, Olivia. I was thanking the deity that you have not inherited it.
What vice is that?
There's no need for you to know. It's one that 4 Mile shares.
Ah, he's wicked. I knew it. Like a Borgia, you said. A wicked Borgia with black eyes and lines in his face. That must account for the pattern.
Pattern, my dear?
Yes. I can see a strange pattern over his face, not the usual electricity of nerves and muscle. Something laid over that. It fascinated me from the beginning.
What sort of pattern do you mean?
Fantastic. Wonderfully evil. I can't describe it. Give me something to write with. I'll show you.
They stopped before a 600-year-old Chippendale cabinet. Prestaine took out a silver-mounted slab of crystal and handed it to Olivia. She touched it with her fingertip. A black dot appeared. She moved her finger, and the dot elongated into a line. With quick strokes, she sketched the hideous swirls and blazons of a devil mask. Saul Dagenham left the darkened bedroom. A moment later, it was flooded with light as one wall illuminated. It seemed as though a giant mirror reflected Gisbella's bedroom, but with one odd quirk. Gisbella lay in the bed alone, but in the reflection, Saul Dagenham sat on the edge of the bed alone. The mirror was, in fact, a sheet of lead glass separating identical rooms. Dagenham had just illuminated his.
"Love by the clock," Dagenham's voice came through a speaker. "Disgusting."
"No, Saul. Never."
"Frustrating."
"Not that either."
"But unhappy."
"No, you're greedy. Be content with what you've got."
"God knows it's more than I ever had. You're magnificent."
"You're extravagant. Now go to sleep, darling. We're skiing tomorrow."
"No, there's been a change of plan. I've got to work."
"Oh, Saul, you promised me. No more working and fretting and running. Aren't you going to keep your promise?"
"I can't with a war on."
"To hell with the war. You sacrificed enough up at Tycho Sands. They can't ask any more of you."
"I've got one job to finish."
"I'll help you finish it."
"No. You'd best keep out of this, Gisbella."
"You don't trust me."
"I don't want you hurt."
"Nothing can hurt us."
"Foil can."
"What?"
4 Mile is foil. You know that. I know you know."
"But I never..."
"No, you never told me. You're magnificent. Keep faith with me the same way, Gisbella."
"Then how did you find out?"
"Foil slipped."
"How?"
"The name."
4 Mile of Ceres? He bought the Ceres company."
"But Geoffrey 4 Mile."
"He invented it."
"He thinks he invented it. He remembered it. Geoffrey 4 Mile is the name they use in the megalomania test down in Combined Hospital in Mexico City. I used the mega mood on Foyle when I tried to open him up. The name must have stayed buried in his memory. He dredged it up and thought it was original. That tipped me.
Poor Gully.
Dagenham smiled.
Yes, no matter how we defend ourselves against the outside, we're always licked by something from the inside. There's no defense against betrayal, and we all betray ourselves.
What are you going to do, Saul?
Do? Finish him, of course.
For 20 pounds of pyre?
No, to win a lost war.
What?
Gisbella came to the glass wall separating the rooms.
You, Saul? Patriotic?
He nodded, almost guiltily.
It's ridiculous, grotesque, but I am. You've changed me completely. I'm a sane man again.
He pressed his face to the wall, too, and they kissed through 3 inches of lead glass.
Mare Nubium was ideally suited to the growth of anaerobic bacteria, soil organisms, phage, rare moulds, and all those microscopic life forms essential to medicine and industry, which required airless culture. Bacteria Inc. was a huge mosaic of culture fields traversed by catwalks, spread around a central clump of barracks, offices and plant. Each field was a giant glass vat, 100 feet in diameter, 12 inches high, and no more than 2 molecules thick. A day before the sunrise line, creeping across the face of the moon, reached Mare Nubium, the vats were filled with culture medium. At sunrise, abrupt and blinding on the airless moon, the vats were seeded, and for the next 14 days of continuous sun, they were tended, shielded, regulated, nurtured. The field workers trudging up and down the catwalks in spacesuits. As the sunset line crept toward Mare Nubium, the vats were harvested and then left to freeze and sterilize in the 2-week frost of the lunar night. Jaunting was of no use in this tedious step-by-step cultivation. Hence Bacteria Inc. hired unfortunates incapable of jaunting and paid them slave wages. This was the lowest form of labor, the dregs and scum of the solar system, and the barracks of Bacteria Inc. resembled an inferno during the 2-week layoff period. Foyle discovered this when he entered Barrack 3. He was met by an appalling spectacle. There were 200 men in the giant room. There were whores and their hard-eyed pimps, professional gambles and their portable tables, dope peddlers, moneylenders. There was a haze of acrid smoke and the stench of alcohol and analogue. Furniture, bedding, clothes, unconscious bodies, empty bottles, rotting food were scattered on the floor. A roar challenged Foyle's appearance, but he was equipped to handle this situation. He spoke to the first hairy face thrust into his. "Kempsey?"
he asked quietly. He was answered outrageously. Nevertheless, he grinned and handed the man a 100-krone note.
"Kempsey?"
he asked another. He was insulted. He paid again, and continued his saunter down the barracks, distributing 100-krone notes in calm thanks for insult and invective. In the centre of the barracks he found his key man, the obvious barracks bully, a monster of a man, naked, hairless, fondling 2 boards and being fed whiskey by sycophants.
"Kempsey?"
Foyle asked in the old gutter tongue.
"I'm digging Roger Kempsey." "I'm digging you for broke,"
the man answered, thrusting out a huge paw for Foyle's money.
"Gimme!"
There was a delighted howl from the crowd. Foyle smiled and spat in his eye. There was an abject hush. The hairless man dumped the boards and surged up to annihilate Foyle. 5 seconds later he was grovelling on the floor, with Foyle's foot planted on his neck.
"Still digging, Kempsey,"
Foyle said gently.
"Digging hard, man. You better finger him, man, or you gone is all."
"Washroom!"
the airless man howled.
"Hold up! Washroom!"
"Now you broke me," Foyle said.
He dumped the rest of his money on the floor before the hairless man and walked quickly to the washroom. Kempsey was cowering in the corner of a shower, face pressed to the wall, moaning in a dull rhythm that showed he had been at it for hours.
"Kempsey!"
The moaning answered him.
"What's the matter, you?"
Clothes,
Kempsey wept.
Clothes, all over clothes, like filth, like sick, like dirt. Clothes, all over clothes.
Up, man, get up.
Clothes, all over clothes, like filth, like sick, like dirt.
Kempsey, mind me, man, or else sent me.
Kempsey stopped weeping and turned his sodden countenance to Foyle.
Who?
Sergei Aurel sent me. I bought your release. You're free. We'll blow.
When?
Now.
Oh, God. God bless him. Bless him.
Kempsey began to caper in weary exultation. The bruised and bloated face split into a facsimile of laughter. He laughed and capered, and Foyle led him out of the washroom. But in the barracks he screamed and wept again, and as Foyle led him down the long room, the naked boards swept up armfuls of dirty clothes and shook them before his eyes. Kempsey foamed and gibbered.
"What's the matter, him?"
Foyle inquired of the hairless man in the gutter patois. The hairless man was now a respectful neutral, if not a friend.
"Guess us for grabs," he answered. "Always like that, him. Show old clothes and he twitch. Man... For why already? For why? Crazy is all."
At the main office airlock, Foyle got Kempsey and himself corked in suits, and then led him out to the rocket field, where a score of anti-grav beams pointed their pale fingers upward from pits to the gibbous earth hanging in the night sky. They entered a pit, entered Foyle's yawl, and uncorked. Foyle took a bottle and a sting ampule from a cabinet. He poured a drink and handed it to Kempsey. He hefted the ampule in his palm, smiling. Kempsey drank the whiskey, still dazed, still exulting.
"Free," he muttered. "God bless him! Free! Christ, what I've been through!"
He drank again.
"I still can't believe it. It's like a dream. Why don't you take off, man?
Kempsey choked and dropped the glass, staring at Foyle in horror.
"Your face," he exclaimed. "My God, your face! What happened to you?"
"You happened to it, you son of a bitch,"
Foyle cried. He leaped up, his tiger face burning, and flung the ampule like a knife. It pierced Kempsey's neck and hung quivering. Kempsey toppled. Foyle accelerated, blurred to the body, picked it up in mid-fall, and carried it aft to the starboard stateroom. There were two main staterooms in the yawl, and Foyle had prepared both of them in advance. The starboard room had been stripped and turned into a surgery. Foyle strapped the body on the operating table, opened a case of surgical instruments, and began the delicate operation he had learned by hypno-training that morning, an operation made possible only by his 5-to-1 acceleration. He cut through skin and fascia, sawed through the ribcage, exposed the heart, dissected it out, and connected veins and arteries to the intricate blood pump alongside the table. He started the pump. 20 seconds, objective time, had elapsed. He placed an oxygen mask over Kempsey's face and switched on the alternating suction and ructation of the oxygen pump. Foyle decelerated, checked Kempsey's temperature, shot an anti-shock series into his veins, and waited. Blood gurgled through the pump and Kempsey's body. After 5 minutes, Foyle removed the oxygen mask. The respiration reflex continued. Kempsey was without a heart, yet alive. Foyle sat down alongside the operating table and waited. The stigmata still showed on his face. Kempsey remained unconscious. Foyle waited. Kempsey awoke, screaming. Foyle leaped up, tightened the straps, and leaned over the heartless man.
"Hello, Kempsey," he said.
Kempsey screamed.
"Look at yourself, Kempsey. You're dead."
Kempsey fainted. Foyle brought him to with the oxygen mask.
"Let me die, for God's sake."
"What's the matter? Does it hurt? I died for 6 months and I didn't whine."
"Let me die."
"In time, Kempsey. Your sympathetic block's been bypassed, but I'll let you die in time, if you behave. You were aboard Vorga on September 16th, 2436.
"For Christ's sake, let me die."
"You were aboard Vorga?"
"Yes."
"You passed a wreck out in space, wreck of the Nomad. She signaled for help and you passed her by, yes?"
"Yes."
"Why?"
Christ! Oh, Christ, help me!
Why?
Oh, Jesus!
I was a bored nomad, Kempsey. Why did you lead me to rot?
Sweet Jesus, help me. Christ, deliver me.
I'll deliver you, Kempsey, if you answer questions. Why did you leave me to rot?
Couldn't pick you up.
Why not?
Ref support.
Oh, I guessed right then. You were running refugees from Callisto.
Yes.
How many?
600.
That's a lot. But you could have made room for one more. Why didn't you pick me up?
We were scuttling the refs.
What? Foyle cried.
Overboard. All of them. 600. Stripped them. Took their clothes, money, jewels, baggage. Put them through the airlock in batches. Christ! The clothes all over the ship. The shrieking and the... Jesus! If I could only forget. The naked women. Blue. Busting wide open, spinning behind us. The clothes all over the ship. 600. Scuttled.
You son of a bitch. It was a racket. You took their money and never intended bringing them to Earth?
It was a racket.
And that's why you didn't pick me up?
Would have had to scuttle you anyway.
Who gave the order?
Captain.
Name?
Joyce. Lindsay Joyce.
Address?
Scopsy Colony, Mars.
What? Foyle was thunderstruck. He's a Scopsy? You mean after hunting him for a year I can't touch him, hurt him, make him feel what I felt? He turned away from the tortured man on the table, equally tortured himself by frustration. A Scopsy. The one thing I never figured on. After preparing that port stateroom for him, what am I going to do? What in God's name am I going to do? He roared in fury, the stigmata showing livid on his face. He was recalled by a desperate moan from Kempsey. He returned to the table and bent over the dissected body. Let's get it straight for the last time. The Scopsy Lindsay Joyce gave the order to scuttle the refs?
Yes.
And to let me rot?
Yes, 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 for God's sake, that's enough. Let me die.
Live, you pig man. Filthy, heartless bastard, live without a heart. Live and suffer. I'll keep you alive forever, you...
A lurid flash of light caught Foyle's eye. He looked up. His burning image was peering through the large square porthole of the stateroom. As he leaped to the porthole, the burning man disappeared. Foyle left the stateroom and darted forward to main controls, where the observation bubble gave him 270 degrees of vision. The burning man was nowhere in sight.
It's not real, he muttered. It couldn't be real. It's a sign, a good luck sign, a guardian angel. It saved me on the Spanish stairs. It's telling me to go ahead and find Lindsay Joyce.
He strapped himself into the pilot chair, ignited the yawl's jets, and slammed into full acceleration.
Lindsay Joyce, Scopsy Colony, Mars,
he thought, as he was thrust back deep into the pneumatic chair.
A Scopsy. Without senses, without pleasure, without pain. The ultimate in stoic escape. How am I going to punish him, torture him, put him in the port stateroom and make him feel what I felt aboard Nomad? Damnation. It's as though he's dead. He is dead. And I've got to figure out how to beat a dead body and make it feel pain. To come so close to the end and have the door slammed in your face. The damnable frustration of revenge. Revenge is for dreams, never for reality.
An hour later, he released himself from the acceleration and his fury, unbuckled himself from the chair, and remembered Kempsey. He went aft to the surgery. The extreme acceleration of the takeoff had choked the blood pump enough to kill Kempsey. Suddenly Foyle was overcome with a novel, passionate revulsion for himself. He fought it helplessly.
"What's the matter, you?" he whispered. "Think of the 600 scuttled. Think of yourself. Are you turning into a white-livered cellar Christian, turning the other cheek and whining forgiveness? Olivia, what are you doing to me? Give me strength, not cowardice."
Nevertheless, he averted his eyes as he scuttled the body. Chapter 13 All persons known to be in the employ of 4 Mile of Sirius or associated with him in any capacity to be held for questioning. YY, Central Intelligence.
All employees of this company to maintain strict watch for 1 4 Mile of Sirius and report at once to local Mr. Presto. Prestain. All couriers will abandon present assignments and report for reassignment to foil case, Dagenham.
Our bank holiday will be declared immediately in the name of the war crisis to cut 4 Mile off from all funds. YY, Central Intelligence.
Anyone making inquiries re-SS Forga to be taken to Castle Prestain for examination. Prestain.
All ports and fields in inner planets to be alerted for arrival of 4 Mile. Quarantine and customs to check all landings. YY, Central Intelligence.
Old St. Patrick's to be searched and watched. Dagenham. The files of Bonus and Uig to be checked for names of officers and men of Vorga to anticipate a possible Foyle's next move. Prestain.
War Crimes Commission to make up list of public enemies, giving Foyle number one spot. YY, Central Intelligence.
1 million krone reward offered for information leading to apprehension of 4 Mile of Sirius, alias Gulliver Foyle, alias Gully Foyle, now at large in the inner planets. Priority, urgent, dangerous.
After 2 centuries of colonization, the air struggle on Mars was still so critical that the VL law, the Vegetative Lynch Law, was still in effect. It was a killing offence to endanger or destroy any plant vital to the transformation of Mars's carbon dioxide atmosphere into an oxygen atmosphere. Even blades of grass were sacred. There was no need to erect keep-off-the-grass neons. The man who wandered off a path onto a lawn would be instantly shot. The woman who picked a flower would be killed without mercy. 2 centuries of sudden death had inspired a reverence for green-growing things that almost amounted to a religion. Foyle remembered this as he raced up the centre of the causeway leading to Mars Saint-Michel. He had jaunted direct from the Syrtis airport to the Saint-Michel stage, at the foot of the causeway which stretched for 1/4 mile through fields to Mars Saint-Michel. The rest of the distance had to be traversed on foot. Like the original Mont Saint-Michel on the French coast, Mars Saint-Michel was a majestic Gothic cathedral of spires and buttresses looming on a hill and yearning toward the sky. Ocean tides surrounded Mont Saint-Michel on Earth. Green tides of grass surrounded Mars Saint-Michel. Both were fortresses. Mont Saint-Michel had been a fortress of faith before organized religion was abolished. Mars Saint-Michel was a fortress of telepathy. Within it lived Mars's soul-full telepath, Sigurd Magsman.
"Now these are the defences protecting Sigurd Magsman," Foyle chanted, halfway between hysteria and litany. "Firstly, the solar system. Secondly, martial law. Thirdly, Dagenham, Prestain and Company. Fourthly, the fortress itself. Fifthly, the uniformed guards, attendants, servants and admirers of the bearded sage we all know so well, Sigurd Magsman, selling his awesome powers for awesome prices."
Foyle laughed immoderately.
"But there's a sixth that I know. Sigurd Magsman's Achilles heel. For I've paid 1 million krone to Sigurd the Third." Or was he fourth?
He passed through the outer labyrinth of Mars Saint-Michel with his forged credentials, and was tempted to bluff or proceed directly by commando action to an audience with the great man himself. But time was pressing, and his enemies were closing in, and he could not afford to satisfy his curiosity. Instead, he accelerated, blurred, and found a humble cottage set in a walled garden within the Mars Saint-Michel home farm. It had drab windows and a thatched roof, and might have been mistaken for a stable. Foyle slipped inside. The cottage was a nursery. 3 pleasant nannies sat motionless in rocking chairs, knitting poised in their frozen hands. The blur that was Foyle came up behind them and quietly stung them with ampules. Then he decelerated. He looked at the ancient, ancient child, the wizened, shriveled boy who was seated on the floor playing with electronic trains.
"Hello, Sigurd," Foyle said.
The child began to cry.
"Cry, baby. What are you afraid of? I'm not going to hurt you."
You're a bad man with a bad face.
I'm your friend, Sigurd.
No, you're not. You want me to do bad things.
I'm your friend. Look, I know all about those big, hairy men who pretend to be you, but I won't tell. Read me and see.
You're going to hurt him, and you want me to tell him.
Who?
The captain man. The Sklip... Scott...
The child fumbled with the word, wailing louder.
Go away! You're bad! Badness in your head and burning men's and...
Come here, Sigurd.
No! Nanny! Nanny!
Shut up, you little bastard!
Foyle grabbed the 70-year-old child and shook it.
This is going to be a brand new experience for you, Sigurd. The first time you've ever been walloped into anything, understand?
The ancient child read him and howled.
Shut up! We're going on a trip to the Skopje colony. If you behave yourself and do what you're told, I'll bring you back and give you a lollipop, or whatever the hell they bribe you with. If you don't behave, I'll beat the living daylights out of you.
No, you won't. You won't. I'm Sigurd Magsman. I'm Sigurd the telepath. You wouldn't dare...
Sonny, I'm Gully Foyle, Solar Enemy Number One. I'm just a step away from the finish of a year-long hunt. I'm risking my neck because I need you to settle accounts with a son of a bitch who... Sonny, I'm Gully Foyle. There isn't anything I wouldn't dare.
The telepath began broadcasting terror with such an uproar that alarms sounded all over Mar Saint-Michel. Foyle took a firm grip on the ancient child, accelerated, and carried him out of the fortress. Then he jaunted.
Urgent. Sigurd Magsman kidnapped by man tentatively identified as Gulliver Foyle, alias 4 Mile of Ceres, Solar Enemy Number One. Destination tentatively fixed. Alert Commando Brigade. Inform Central Intelligence. Urgent, urgent, urgent.
The ancient Skopsky sect of White Russia, believing that sex was the root of all evil, practiced an atrocious self-castration to extirpate the root. The modern Skopskys, believing that sensation was the root of all evil, practiced an even more barbaric custom. Having entered the Skopsky colony and paid a fortune for the privilege, the initiates submitted joyously to an operation that severed the sensory nervous system, and lived out their days without sight, sound, speech, smell, taste, or touch. When they first entered the monastery, the initiates were shown elegant ivory cells, in which it was intimated they would spend the remainder of their lives in rapt contemplation, lovingly tended. In actuality, the senseless creatures were packed in catacombs, where they sat on rough stone slabs and were fed and exercised once a day. For 23 out of the 24 hours, they sat alone in the dark, untended, unguarded, unloved.
The living dead,
Foyle muttered. He decelerated, put Sigurd Magsman down, and switched on the retinal light in his eyes, trying to pierce the womb gloom. It was midnight above ground. It was permanent midnight down in the catacombs. Sigurd Magsman was broadcasting terror and anguish with such a telepathic bray that Foyle was forced to shake the child again.
Shut up, he whispered. You can't wake these dead. Now find me Lindsay Joyce.
They're sick, all sick, like worms in their heads, worms and sickness and...
Christ, don't I know it. Come on, let's get it over with. There's worse to come.
They went down the twisting labyrinth of the catacombs. The stone slabs shelved the walls from floor to ceiling. The Skopskys, white as slugs, mute as corpses, motionless as Buddhas, filled the caverns with the odour of living death. The telepathic child wept and shrieked. Foyle never relaxed his relentless grip on him. He never relaxed the hunt.
Johnson, Wright, Keeley, Graff, Nastro, Underwood... God, there's thousands here.
Foyle read off the bronze identification plates attached to the slabs.
Reach out, Sigurd. Find Lindsay Joyce for me. We can't go over them name by name. Regal, Cone, Brady, Vincent... What in the...
Foyle started back. One of the bone-white figures had cuffed his brow. It was swaying and writhing, its face twitching. All the white slugs on their shelves were squirming and writhing. Sigurd Magsman's constant telepathic broadcast of anguish and terror was reaching them and torturing them.
Shut up, Foyle snapped. Stop it. Find Lindsay Joyce and we'll get out of here. Reach out and find him.
Down there, Sigurd wept. Straight down there. 7, 8, 9 shelves down. I want to go home. I'm sick.
Foyle went pell-mell down the catacombs with Sigurd, reading off identification plates until at last he came to Lindsay Joyce, Bougainville, Venus. This was his enemy, the instigator of his death, and the deaths of the 600 from Callisto. This was the enemy for whom he had planned vengeance and hunted for months. This was the enemy for whom he had prepared the agony of the port stateroom aboard his yawl. This was Vorga. It was a woman.
Foyle was thunderstruck.
In these days of the double standard, with women kept in Perda, there were many reported cases of women masquerading as men to enter the worlds close to them. But he had never yet heard of a woman in the Merchant Marine masquerading her way to top officer rank.
"This," he exclaimed furiously, "this is Lindsay Joyce? Lindsay Joyce of the Vorga? Ask her."
"I don't know what Vorga is."
"Ask her."
"But I don't... She was... She, like, gave orders."
"Captain."
"I don't like what's inside her. It's all sick and dark. It hurts. I want to go home."
"Ask her. Was she captain of the Vorga?"
"Yes. Please, 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 don't make me go inside her any more. It's twisty and hurts. I don't like her."
"Tell her I'm the man she wouldn't pick up on September 16th, 2436. Tell her it's taken a long time, but I've finally come to settle the account. Tell her I'm going to pay her back."
I don't understand. Don't understand."
"Tell her I'm going to kill her, slow and hard. Tell her I've got a stateroom aboard my yawl, fitted up just like my locker aboard Nomad, where I rotted for 6 months. Where she ordered Vorga to leave me to die. Tell her she's going to rot and die just like me. Tell her!"
Foyle shook the wizened child furiously.
"Make her feel it. Don't let her get away by turning Skopsky. Tell her I will kill her filthy. Read me and tell her."
She didn't give that order."
"What?"
I can't understand her."
"She didn't give the order to scuttle me?"
"I'm afraid to go in."
"Go in, you little son of a bitch, or I'll take you apart. What does she mean?"
The child wailed. The woman writhed. Foyle fumed.
"Go in, go in. Get it out of her. Jesus Christ, why does the only telepath on Mars have to be a child? Sigurd, listen to me. Ask her. Did she give the order to scuttle the refs?"
"No, no."
"No, she didn't, or no, you won't."
"She didn't."
"Did she give the order to pass Nomad by?"
"She's twisty and sicky. Oh, please, Nanny, I want to go home. Want to go."
"Did she give the order to pass Nomad by?"
"No."
"She didn't?"
"No, take me home."
"Ask her who did."
"I want my Nanny."
"Ask her who could give her an order. She was captain aboard her own ship. Who could command her? Ask her."
"I want my Nanny."
"Ask her."
"No, no, no. I'm afraid. She's sick. She's dark and black. She's bad. I don't understand her. I want my Nanny. I want to go home."
The child was shrieking and shaking. Foyle was shouting. The echoes thundered. As Foyle reached for the child in a rage, his eyes were blinded by brilliant light. The entire catacomb was illuminated by the burning man. Foyle's image stood before him, face hideous, clothes on fire, the blazing eyes fixed on the convulsing Skopsky that had been Lindsay Joyce. The burning man opened his tiger mouth. A grating sound emerged. It was like flaming laughter.
"She hurts," he said. "Who are you?"
Foyle whispered. The burning man winced.
"Too bright," he said. "Less light."
Foyle took a step forward. The burning man clapped hands over his ears in agony.
"Too loud," he cried. "Don't move so loud." "Are you my guardian angel?" You're blinding me. Shh!
Suddenly he laughed again.
Listen to her. She's screaming, begging. She doesn't want to die. She doesn't want to be hurt. Listen to her.
Foyle trembled.
She's telling us who gave the order. Can't you hear? Listen with your eyes.
The burning man pointed a taloned finger at the writhing Skopsky.
She says, Olivia.
What?
She says, Olivia. Olivia Prestane. Olivia Prestane. Olivia Prestane.
The burning man vanished. The catacombs were dark again. Coloured light and cacophonies swirled around Foyle. He gasped and staggered.
Blue jaunt, he muttered. Olivia. No, not... never.
Olivia. I...
He felt a hand reach for his.
Jizz,
he croaked. He became aware that Sigurd Magsman was holding onto his hand and weeping. He picked the boy up.
I heard,
Sigurd whimpered.
I heard too, son.
Want to go home?
I'll take you home.
Still holding the boy in his arms, he blundered through the catacombs.
The living dead,
he mumbled. And then,
I've joined them.
He found the stone steps that led up from the depths to the monastery cloister above ground. He trudged up the steps, tasting death and desolation. There was a bright light above him, and for a moment he imagined that dawn had come already. Then he realized that the cloister was brilliantly lit with artificial light. There was the tramp of shod feet and the low growl of commands. Halfway up the steps, Foyle stopped and mustered himself.
Sigurd, he whispered, who's above us? Find out.
Soldiers,
the child answered.
Soldiers? What soldiers?
Commando soldiers.
Sigurd's crumpled face brightened.
They come for me. They take me home to Nanny. Here I am. Here I am.
The telepathic clamour brought a shout from overhead. Foyle accelerated and blurred up the rest of the steps to the cloister. It was a square of Romanesque arches surrounding a green lawn. In the centre of the lawn was a giant cedar of Lebanon. The flagged walks swarmed with commando search parties, and Foyle came face to face with his match. For an instant after they saw his blur whip up from the catacombs, they accelerated too, and all were on even terms. But Foyle had the boy. Shooting was impossible. Cradling Sigurd in his arms, he wove through the cloister like a broken field runner hurtling toward a goal. No one dared block him, for at +5 acceleration, a head-on collision between two bodies would be instantly fatal to both. Objectively, this breakneck skirmish looked like a 5-second zigzag of lightning. Foyle broke out of the cloister, went through the main hall of the monastery, passed through the labyrinth, and reached the public jaunt stage outside the main gate. There he stopped, decelerated, and jaunted to the monastery airfield, half a mile distant. The field, too, was ablaze with lights and swarming with commandos. Every anti-grav pit was occupied by a brigade ship. His own yawl was under guard. A fifth of a second after Foyle arrived at the field, the pursuers from the monastery jaunted in. He looked around desperately. He was surrounded by half a regiment of commandos, all under acceleration, all geared for lethal action, all his equal or better. The odds were impossible. And then the outer satellites altered the odds. Exactly 1 week after the saturation raid on Terra, they struck at Mars. Again, the missiles came down on the midnight to dawn quadrant. Again, the heavens twinkled with interceptions and detonations, and the horizon exploded great puffs of light while the ground shook. But this time there was a ghastly variation. For a brilliant nova burst overhead, flooding the night side of the planet with garish light. A swarm of fission heads had struck Mars's tiny satellite, Phobos, instantly vaporizing it into a sunlet. The recognition lag of the commandos to this appalling attack gave Foyle his opportunity. He accelerated again and burst through them to his yawl. He stopped before the main hatch and saw the stunned guard party hesitate between a continuance of the old action and a response to the new. Foyle hurled the frozen body of Sigurd Magsman up into the air like a Scotsman tossing the caber. As the guard party rushed to catch the boy, Foyle dove through them into his yawl, slammed the hatch, and dogged it. Still under acceleration, never pausing to see if anyone was inside the yawl, he shot forward to controls, ripped the release lever, and as the yawl started to float up the anti-grav beam, threw on full 10G propulsion. He was not strapped into the pilot chair. The effect of the 10G drive on his accelerated and unprotected body was monstrous. A creeping force took hold of him and spilled him out of the chair. He inched back toward the rear wall of the control chamber like a sleepwalker. The wall appeared to his accelerated senses to approach him. He thrust out both arms, palms flat against the wall, to brace himself. The sluggish power thrusting him back split his arms apart and forced him against the wall gently at first, then harder and harder, until face, jaw, chest, and body were crushed against the metal. The mounting pressure became agonizing. He tried to trip the switchboard in his mouth with his tongue, but the propulsion crushing him against the wall made it impossible for him to move his distorted mouth. A burst of explosions, so far down the sound spectrum that they sounded like sodden rock slides, told him that the commando brigade was bombarding him with shots from below. As the yawl tore up into the blue-black of outer space, he began to scream in a bat screech before he mercifully lost consciousness. Chapter 14. Foyle awoke in darkness. He was decelerated, but the exhaustion of his body told him he had been under acceleration while he had been unconscious. Either his power pack had run out, or... He inched a hand to the small of his back. The pack was gone. It had been removed. He explored with trembling fingers. He was in a bed. He listened to the murmur of ventilators and refrigerants, and the click and buzz of servo mechanisms. He was aboard a ship. He was strapped to the bed, and the ship was in free fall. Foyle unfastened himself, pressed his elbows against the mattress, and floated up. He drifted through the darkness, searching for a light switch or a call button. His hands brushed against a water carafe with raised letters on the glass. He read them with his fingertips. S.S., he felt. V.O.R.G.A. Vorga! He cried out. The door of the stateroom opened. A figure drifted through the door, silhouetted against the light of a luxurious private lounge behind it. "This time we picked you up," a voice said.
"Olivia?"
"Yes."
"Then it's true."
"Yes, Gully." Foyle began to cry. "You're still weak," Olivia Prestain said gently. "Come and lie down." She urged him into the lounge and strapped him into a chaise longue. It was still warm from her body. "You've been like this for 6 days. We never thought you'd live. Everything was drained out of you before the surgeon found that battery on your back."
"Where is it?"
he croaked. "You can have it whenever you want it. Don't fret, my dear." He looked at her for a long moment. His snow maiden, his beloved ice princess, the white satin skin, the blind coraled eyes, an exquisite coral mouth. She touched his moist eyelids with a scented handkerchief.
"I love you,"
he said. "Shh, I know, Gully."
"You've known all about me. For how long?"
"I knew Gully Foyle was my enemy from the beginning. I never knew he was Fourmile until we met. Ah, if only I'd known before. How much would have been saved?"
"You knew, and you've been laughing at me."
"No."
"Standing by and shaking with laughter."
"Standing by and loving you. No, don't interrupt. I'm trying to be rational, and it's not easy." A flush cascaded across the marble face. "I'm not playing with you now. I betrayed you to my father. I did.
Self-defense, I thought. Now that I've met him at last, I can see he's too dangerous. An hour later, I knew it was a mistake, because I realized I was in love with you. I'm paying for it now. You need never have known.
You expect me to believe that?
Then why am I here? She trembled slightly. Why did I follow you? That bombing was ghastly. You'd have been dead in another minute when we picked you up. Your yawl was a wreck.
Where are we now?
What difference does it make?
I'm stalling for time.
Time for what?
Not for time. I'm stalling for courage.
We're orbiting Terra.
How did you follow me?
I knew you'd be after Lindsay Joyce. I took over one of my father's ships. It happened to be the Vorga again.
Does he know?
He never knows. I live my own private life. He could not take his eyes off her, and yet it hurt him to look at her. He was yearning and hating, yearning for the reality to be undone, hating the truth for what it was. He discovered that he was stroking her handkerchief with tremulous fingers.
I love you, Olivia.
I love you, Gully, my enemy.
For God's sake, he burst out. Why did you do it?
What? She lashed back. Are you demanding apologies?
I'm demanding an explanation.
You'll get none from me.
Blood and money, your father said. He was right. Oh, bitch, bitch, bitch!
Blood and money, yes, and unashamed.
I'm drowning, Olivia. Throw me a lifeline.
Then drown. Nobody ever saved me. No, no, this is wrong, all wrong. Wait, my dear, wait. She composed herself and began speaking very tenderly. I could lie, Gully dear, and make you believe it, but I'm going to be honest. There's a simple explanation. I live my own private life. We all do. You do.
What's yours?
No different from yours, from the rest of the world. I cheat, I lie, I destroy, like all of us. I'm criminal, like all of us.
Why? For money? You don't need money.
No.
For control? Power?
Not for power.
Then why?
She took a deep breath, as though this truth was the first truth and was crucifying her.
For hatred. To pay you back, all of you.
For what?
For being blind, she said in a smouldering voice. For being cheated, for being helpless. They should have killed me when I was born. Do you know what it's like to be blind, to receive life second-hand, to be dependent, begging, crippled? Bring them down to your level, I told my secret life. If you're blind, make them blinder. If you're helpless, cripple them. Pay them back, all of them.
Olivia, you're insane.
And you?
I'm in love with a monster.
We're a pair of monsters.
No.
No, not you, she flared. What have you been doing but paying the world back like me? What's your revenge but settling your own private account with bad luck? Who wouldn't call you a crazy monster? I tell you, we're a pair, Gully. We couldn't help falling in love.
He was stunned by the truth of what she said. He tried on the shroud of her revelation, and it fit, clung tighter than the tiger mask tattooed on his face.
Remorseless, he said. Lecherous, treacherous, kindless villain. It's true. I'm no better than you, worse. But before God, I never murdered 600.
You're murdering 6 million.
What?
Perhaps more. You've got something they need to end the war, and you're holding out.
You mean Pyre?
Yes.
What is it, this bringer of peace, this 20 pounds of miracle that they're fighting for?
I don't know, but I know they need it, and I don't care. Yes, I'm being honest now. I don't care. Let millions be murdered. It makes no difference to us, not to us, Gully, because we stand apart. We stand apart and shape our own world. We're the strong.
We're the damned.
We're the blessed. We've found each other.